Okay, that was abrupt and I'm late, but that's all right. Lecture's a little shorter than normal today. Let me go through the logistics of how the semester is ending. This is, of course, the last lecture, the last of three presentations. Did anyone have any trouble finding, listening to, or getting the impact of the lecture on population communities? Everybody got that? It's online? Well, I'm going to get to that eventually, right? Okay. So there's this presentation, the population community piece, and then collective behavior, all of which will relate to the final exam, which is on Friday at 7:30 in the morning. I guess that's the first final, isn't it? There, we have scheduled a review. That'll be on Thursday, dead day. It'll be in this room, and your questions will be addressed at that point. The final is just another exam like all the rest. You will see questions on it that you may recall seeing before. There'll be perspectives questions. Fair enough? And once again, you all have a total. I mean, the course could end for you now with the total you have. Now, if you've missed an exam, you certainly want to replace that by taking the final. But you can also improve your grade by beating your lowest test score by the number you need to get the better grade. 243 points is the A line. I don't do averages. It's just a point total. So if you're 5 points short, let's say, you have to beat your lowest test score by 5 points. It's just that simple, because one test will be dropped. Okay? Does everybody kind of understand that? Because I often get questions after the fact that all I had to do was get 5 on my test, and I know I did better than... No, you had to get 5 better than the other test, and there's a difference. Okay? Fair enough? All right. All right, last piece. Social change is, by definition, simply the alteration of culture and society over time. The alteration of culture and society over time. I would argue that in many respects, our world has changed socially in very profound ways. But in another sense, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Karl Marx, we go to on this question, at least because he gives us the best example. He was examining the transition from feudalism as an economic form to capitalism as an economic form. And a feudal society, that's F-E-U-D-A-L, a feudal society distinguished the wealthy from the non-wealthy, or the haves from the have-nots, based on their number of slaves and the amount of land that they owned. It was essentially an agrarian-driven form of culture and an agrarian-driven economy. Marx argued that the Industrial Revolution was not only changing the nature of work, which it was, fewer and fewer people started farming, more and more people started making machines and maintaining machines and finding the fuel to run the machines and all that. That it was not only a change in technology, it was a change in economy. That capitalism as a form of economic reality was now driving society in a different direction, more competitively. It was also creating greater levels of stratification. More and more people had more and more at the expense of more and more who had less and less. Now, I think that Marx would argue, if he were alive now, he would certainly look at C. Wright Mills as a partner in ideology, Mills being the one that came up with the idea of the power elite, looking at the relationship between government politics and corporate economics, and looking at how that has changed and made us even more hyper-capitalistic, hyper-competitive, and so on. I think he would also look at the proliferation of both the availability of information and the power that information holds as another way of saying the same thing. The haves get more, the have-nots get less. The base of the Eiffel Tower gets wider, the height gets taller, I think is what he would say. If you were to ask him, if you could, how is the world that you've just dropped into, 21st century America, different from the 18th century world where you made your career as a theorist and as an economist? And he would say simply, the base is wider, the height is taller. What have we seen that's made that happen? Well, the car, the computer, and the telephone. I talk about them, or have in the past, as distinct entities, but they really aren't anymore. Our cars are driven and run by computers too. There's no such thing as a carburetor or a tune-up anymore. You know, you might want to ask your dads or even your granddads what it was like to actually do a tune-up. A timing light or ignition points and all that kind of stuff, don't need them anymore. The car is run by a computer. The telephone is a computer. It's hard to find a standalone telephone. You can still make rotary telephones work, but they're really, well, they're inscrutable to children. I have a rotary telephone, 40s vintage rotary telephone, sitting on my desk at home just because it's fun. It was an artifact of one of my grandparents. And we had the children, some friends were over for Thanksgiving, as it turns out. And one of the kids, who's six, was looking at this rotary telephone. And he had no idea that you would put your finger in it and go 7, 4, 2, something or other. What he did was he was taking the dial and he was moving it as though you might move a combination lock dial. You know, he said, well, that must be how it works, right? He had no clue. The telephone and the computer are one. We literally have, somewhere I've got it. Oh, it's over here. We literally have the whole world in our hands. You know, we have smartphones and dumb people because we don't have to hold information in our heads anymore. Trivia Pursuit was a very popular game in the 80s. You know, how much information can you recall about arcane things? No need. You want to know who the supporting actor was in a film from 10 years ago? If you know the name of the film, you just Google it. If you don't even know that, if you know who the lead actors were, you could Google them and it'll get the whole, oh, that was the guy, or that was the woman, etc. No need. I mean, Wikipedia has become the gold standard for truth. Have you noticed, or do you know, by the way, that Wikipedia can be edited by anybody? You ever have fun with that? My stepson is, well, he's got my kind of sense of humor. And he went into the Wikipedia entry on the Oklahoma state flag and wrote in it that the word Oklahoma was added to the state flag in 1879 or whatever it was that he just made it up in an effort to improve literacy in a really low literate state. That stayed in there for 5 years. Nobody caught it. I have colleagues who are history professors that tell me that in the run-up to exams, where there are a lot of dates that people have to sort of hold in their minds, they'll go into Wikipedia and start changing the dates so that people don't try to learn it that way. You know. Did you know that the American Revolution happened in 1620? Yeah, says so in Wikipedia. You might want to do that. Go in and just change the entry. Independence Day, July 4th, 1620. See if anybody, you know, as it were. The car, the computer, and the telephone have morphed into one. My grandmother was born in 1905. And as such, she died in 1991. So she died just on the front edge of the internet. I think I sent my first email in that same year. And there was no such thing as hypertext transfer protocols and, you know, all of the kinds of things that we just take for granted now. And that's even changed dramatically in the last 10 years or 7 or 8 years with the invention of the iPhone. But anyway, in her lifetime, somebody Google this for me because I can't remember. What was the date of the Wright brothers' first flight? Somebody just Google it and tell me. Just go Wright brothers' first flight and tell me. I think in my mind it's 1914, but I don't have to remember it anymore because somebody can do it. Anyway, my grandmother was a child when Wilbur and Orville, 1903, that's when they took their first flight? Oh, okay, well then she wasn't a child. She didn't, good thing I didn't record the last lecture because I went hot. 1914 might be the start of Prohibition. I don't know, whatever the heck it is. Anyway, 1903, my grandmother is not yet born but soon will be. So she is witness to among the very first machines that can fly. By 1918, 16 years later, flying machines are being used in combat. World War I flying aces. Not particularly powerful flying machines. By 1940, Bombers and fighters are being used in combat. And, you know, every once in a while, they bring World War II planes to airports, and they raise money for veterans' causes by letting you ride on them. And that's a very good idea. And if you don't ride on them, pay the $3 or $4 to walk through them and imagine what it must have been like for a World War II pilot to fly in these things and try to navigate them basically by eyeball and compass. Try to engage in warfare and compare that to what it's like to get on a plane now. And I have pilot friends that tell me that air travel these days or piloting a plane these days involves nothing more than pushing a button. You know, they steer the plane onto the place, the end of the runway, and push a button, and it just takes off. You know, and they just make minor adjustments. The flight plan has been programmed in. The autopilot takes over. The only time that a pilot actually is at the controls of the plane is on landing, and that's not even necessary. It can be, you can actually land a plane automatically. It's a pretty hard landing, but they can do it. In any case, now that. To say nothing of what happens if something goes wrong. If the failure of technology happens, well then, you know, the training has to be there. But flying a plane these days, a modern commercial aircraft, is almost completely automated now, as is much of whatever else we do, which is intriguing. The automobile changed a lot of things in our lives. It changed the architecture of our world in some ways. The drive-through lane at banks and restaurants and so on. I think the bank was the first place that had auto banking, and that didn't mean automatic, it meant automobile banking. And I remember going through as a kid, I used to like it because the teller behind the window would slide the drawer out with the receipt for whatever it was that my folks were doing, and then there'd be a little sucker in there for the kid. That'd be great, you know. Now you can take your dog through, and then most auto bank tellers have dog treats, and if they see a dog slobbering out the window, they'll throw a dog treat. Have you done that? Anybody? Yeah? It's cool, isn't it? All right. Before, and I don't know if any of them still do here in town, but before liquor sales were allowed in Lubbock, and that happened for the first time in 2009, if you can imagine, packaged liquor sales. So you could buy it by the drink in a restaurant, but you couldn't buy it inside the city. You had to go out to a place that was known as the Strip, which is now sort of a series of empty buildings and vacant lots south of town on the Tohoka Highway. But all those liquor stores had drive-through lanes. I guess that's how Baptists bought beer then. I don't know. Drive-through, tinted windows, I get it. But, you know, the drive-through at the liquor store used to make me go, what? I'll take commercial for drunk driving for $200, you know. It changed courtship practices. In the collective behavior lecture from the first one in this segment, remember I was talking about the urban legend, you know, the hook urban legend, where kids were out parking, you know, that certainly changed how we were able to, let's call it, engage, okay? The city in which I grew up was just 10 miles north of a city in Wisconsin that had a major automobile factory that's no longer in existence. There's no longer an American Motors Corporation. But AMC made cars in Kenosha, Wisconsin. They made Ramblers and Nashes and other things. And if you go to eBay Motors and just find the look of, you know, 50s and 60s cars, the Rambler and the Nash, they're just funny looking cars. But they were made in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And one of their interesting features was that the front seats, the backs of the front seats, dropped such that they were flat with very large back seats, right? And they were marketed in a way that, at least hypothetically, they were sort of the first rolling camper, or at least inexpensive. I mean, you bought a car, you in effect bought a place where you could pull off and take a nap, or do something else creative if you were 16, etc., right? And somebody goes, ew. Yeah, etc. Well, I remembered, because where we lived, it was sort of, you know, supporting local industry. We had Ramblers and Nashes. The first car I drove was a 1959 Rambler. My grandma had that car. And when I was in high school, the family had a 1966 American Motors Ambassador, which was the big version that had the biggest, baddest front-back seat connection. Anyway, let's fast forward out of that era for real quick here. friend of mine in, this must have been 96, 97 or so, was asking his minister, right, what car do you think I want to buy my 16-year-old daughter a brand new car for her 16th birthday. And I'm going, dad of the year? I mean, who does that? I mean, I guess some people do. It was unheard of in my day. But anyway, so he's saying, well, what kind of car do you think I should get this wonderful girl, A student, done real well with her life? I said, and he said, I'm thinking about a Toyota Camry. You know, and that's a reasonable choice. I mean, it's a good car, sturdy, reliable, repair record is impeccable. All the good things you want in a safe, reliable car, the Toyota Camry, and the Honda Accord, and every other car company has a similar model, etc. I said, no, you don't want to get her a Honda, you know, a Toyota Camry. Get her a Mazda Miata. He's going, are you nuts? It's a convertible. It's a two-seater convertible. It's a tin can. I'm going, it has no back seat. He goes, oh, interesting idea. 16-year-old daughter, right? He got her the Camry, which was way small. I was making a joke, but you get the idea. And I think today, the morphing of the telephone and the computer and even the car, although, once again, the more things change, the more they stay the same. My grandmother tells the story of being a 10-year-old and having a telephone in their house for the first time. And the telephone technology is fairly new. But it wasn't a telephone. Well, it was sort of a telephone, but it didn't have a dial on it. You had a gizmo that attached to the wall. And if somebody wanted to make a phone call from their gizmo attached to the wall, they could do so by picking it up. And an operator at a central location would ask, number please. And you'd say 5216. And they would then say, please hold. And they would then lift a wire, punch it into a switchboard, and push a button. And it would ring the phone of that particular phone. All the phones had little holes, had their own little hole in the switchboard. Well, party lines were how these things were first installed. It wasn't only your house that had the 5416 number or whatever it was. The switchboard operator plugged it in and pushed a button, and your ring might be ring, ring, ring. Two longs and a short. And the person down the road might have ring, 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 two shorts and a long. So when your phone rang and it was two long rings and a short one, you knew that somebody wanted to talk to you and you picked the phone up. If it was two shorts and a long, you knew somebody wanted to talk to the people down the road and you picked the phone up anyway so you could listen in because it was a party line. Kind of like having a scanner now for cell phones, right? So the more things change, the more they stay the same. That's how gossip in small towns was spread because people listened in on party lines. I think that's what has happened now is highly ironic in that these massive amounts of technology that are designed to facilitate contact and communication in many respects have the opposite effect. You can be in a room with friends, and you can at the same time be in cyberspace with your real friends on Facebook. Wait a second. It's ubiquitous. You can't stop it. We're in a social situation right now, and you're on your phone for something. I don't know what. I mean, you could be taking notes for all I know, but I just noticed that my world and your world were different just right then. I don't know what you're doing. I'm trying to learn not to have that bug me, but it's just an example. At almost any point in any lecture, if I want to point out this reality, I pretty much can. And having done so with you, I can see that you're still in another room with somebody else, and he doesn't even know I'm talking to him or about him yet. So, oh, yeah. Hello. Need I say more? This will happen to you at lunch, where someone who is your friend will disengage from your world and engage in a world with a cyber friend. And here's what I think may encapsulate in one sentence the most profound change in our social world. Facebook has changed the definition of the word friend. Before Facebook, friend was defined in a particular way. Now it's defined in at least two different ways. And because of that, we've actually had to invent a new word, which I believe was word of the year in the Oxford Dictionary 3 or 4 years ago, called unfriend. We used to just call it dump. Got dumped. Got rejected. Now I've been unfriended. Right? I think that's profound. And the irony of it is what I'm most intrigued by, because I'm a huge fan of inconsistency, hypocrisy, and irony. I think those are the issues that tell us an enormous amount about ourselves and our world. The things about which we are inconsistent. The ironies and even the hypocrisy in our world. I think that Mark Zuckerberg, if you believe it was only him or whoever else jumped onto the idea, has changed the definition of a word irretrievably. And because that's a reality that's occurred only within the last, I don't know, 8 years perhaps. I think Facebook came out in 05, 06, something like that. And the iPhone was invented in, I think, 06, 05. Anyway, I wonder when my 6-year-old granddaughter, who, by the way, just asked Santa for an iPad and a phone for Christmas. Now, the iPad makes sense. They're using them in her school. They have wonderful ways of teaching through the iPad app technology, and we've seen it. The phone, well, Lexi has one. Okay. You know? I wonder what her world will look like when she is 60, as am I today. You know, she's 6. I remember being a 6-year-old very vividly in lots of ways. And this world is much different. I wonder if it will be, and especially it's different in that the escalation in the differences technologically have gotten faster in the last 10 years. I wonder what's going to happen to that pace or that amount of change to which we have to keep up in the next 54 years until she is 60 doing something. I don't know. Maybe we'll all be encased in bubbles. I mean, we are encased in cyber bubbles, are we not? Maybe that's how they'll cure Ebola. Heck, I don't know. Can you imagine it? You will all be alive, presumably, or at least hopefully, when my 6-year-old is 60. I mean, add to your age now, 54 years. Probably, you know. You'll be geezing along, kind of like I am now. You may remember those days when we had antique iPhones. I don't know. But I think, and this is the end of this segment, I think it is the most profound measure of social change, I think, can be just captured by the idea, by the reality, that Facebook has redefined the word, the concept, the meaning, and the terms of friend and friendship. Okay, this last segment for this lecture and for the course revolves around a piece of medical research. It's called the support study. And I want to call your attention to a link here. You've actually got the article itself. This is a piece that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1995. So the study is about 20 years old. And it illustrates the start of a very interesting, in a sense, social movement, but also a level of awareness about another issue that I think is an apt metaphor for a lot of the rest of our lives. The support study, and by the way, it's called that because they've got a cute little acronym, Study to Understand Prognoses, Preferences, and Outcomes and Risks of Treatments. This was a study that involved some 50 investigators, medical researchers, who were given $25 million starting in 1988. $25 million by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's a private nonprofit foundation that funds medical research. To essentially answer one seemingly simple question. How do we die in American teaching hospitals? How do we die? Under what conditions? At whose direction? And by what process does life end? I thought that was an apt topic to finish the course. How do we die in America? I know I'm a sick, sorry human being. I understand that part. But let's just look at the title, Study to Understand. All studies are designed to understand something. To understand, first of all, prognoses. What the heck's a prognosis? Anybody know? I had my annual physical exam this morning. I was given several prognoses because I turned 60, and now weird things start to happen to you, you know, and you have to do things to sort of ward that off. It's different. Anyway, what's a prognosis? What is that? It's a doctor gives you a prognosis, and it's what he or she thinks will happen. Okay? Prognosis is what the doctor thinks will happen. What's a preference? You know, come on. It's what we want to have happen. I mean, we think this will happen. We want to have this happen. That may or may not be the same thing, right? What's an outcome? That's what happened. We think this will happen. We hope this happens. This is what happened. And if you're in a hospital, there are risks involved with treatment. This is a study that took several years to complete. It was started in 1988 with exactly 9,105 participants. 9,105 participants who were demographically characterized in this way. Their average age was 65. And when I first started doing this presentation now 20 years ago, because I actually went to a seminar that occurred in Lubbock given by one of the principal investigators of this study. It was a riveting presentation. And when it was done, I went up to her and I said, can I have those slides? My students need to see this. And she was generous enough to give me the overheads. Now we don't use overhead projectors anymore. I've made a PDF and we got them on the internet and we, you know, etc. Used to have to slide things on and off an overhead projector. Talk about paging Thomas Edison. But anyway, some of you don't even know who he was, I'll bet. Never mind. This is the group. 65-ish years old, 44% female, a little bit underrepresented for female, a little bit overrepresented for African Americans. Here are the two numbers that are important. These 9,105 people, 26% of them died during the first hospitalization they were in the study. Okay. 47% of them died within 6 months. So we've got an aging population with a coin flip's chance of living 6 months. We're not talking about 20-year-olds coming into hospitals after being in car accidents. We're talking about people who are up in years and who are suffering from things like terminal metastatic cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, end stage of pick your disease. These are people, essentially, with a coin flip's chance of living 6 months, that's the prognosis. Flip a coin, you might or might not live 6 months, and everybody knows it. They've been told, the doctor who told them certainly knows, the family knows. This is a pretty unique group of people. It makes me think of a woman I knew several years ago now. She died in 1998, as it turns out. But anyway, she was my parishioner, and I was her minister, and you know, she went in for some very serious surgery. We weren't quite sure how serious, right? Well, anyway, I just happened to check in on her family right about the time in the family waiting room, and you've been to these places in hospitals, right about the time the doctor comes in to give him the news. And I walked in from one door about the same time the doctor did, and the doctor didn't see me, but said to the family, let's talk in here. And when they take you out of the waiting room into the consult room, that's a pretty good sign you're going to hear some bad news. So I just trailed along because the family brought me in. The doctor told us that what we had feared was what he believed was right, that the tumor they removed from her brain looked like the worst possible kind. And if pathology reported that to be the case, she would, no matter what they did, she would not live beyond a year and more likely closer to 6 months. Okay, and so the family absorbs this, although it really wasn't a surprise. I mean, the run-up to this suggested this was a fairly likely eventuality. So then the doctor leaves, and we're just talking, and I'm being their minister, which is not easy to do in a situation like that, although I've done it lots of times. They asked me if I would, when she got home, tell her the details of that. You know, they were going to say, you know, until the time she was out of surgery and home, they were going to sort of evade the question a little bit. which was really dumb because this was a very astute woman. She knew what was what right off the bat. But anyway, she played along. So they got home from the hospital. I went to visit in the house the next day. And we're just chatting, drinking coffee. And finally, the daughter goes, and I get the sign like, now's the time to tell her. So I basically said, well, you know, when we were in the waiting room, the doc came in and he told us pretty much what we had talked about before and had most feared, that this, in fact, was the kind of tumor that was as bad as these types of tumors get. And you might live a year and you might make it 6 months. And I told it to her pretty much that way because I loved and respected this woman and understood that she liked the news to be straight. The kids were wrong in evading this in my mind. But anyway, now I'll tell you how I know this. I said that. It was this little moment of silence, and the kids are wiping their eyes. And she goes, well, guess I won't bother cleaning those closets. I told that story at her funeral, and they all did the same thing. That's Marge. That's who she was. The ability to absorb a prognosis, express a preference, and change the outcome, or at least determine the outcome within parameters, is what we all want for ourselves and for people we love. This study answered the question, who gets it? Who gets to say, well, I guess I won't clean those closets, or not? The study was done in two phases. The first phase, roughly 4,500 of these 9,105 respondents, were in a teaching hospital with a 50-50 chance of living 6 months. All of them had very serious illnesses. And all the research team did was watch them. They just took notes on what happened to them, on the nature of the conversations and the topics that were addressed by their care team. The first thing they were interested in learning was to what extent was the question of CPR, no CPR brought up. These days, it almost goes without saying, although surprisingly it still doesn't, you really have to say, and there are actually very prescribed ways to say it. Let's say I know that I'm a coin flip's chance of living 6 months, and I'm going to be hospitalized for much of that time, and I'm going to be getting sicker and sicker by the day. What happens if suddenly my body gives up, my heart stops? In a hospital, unless told otherwise, the default is all hell breaks loose and they try to start it by whatever means they can. Chemically, mechanically, electrically, they try to get you geezing back along again. Unless you tell them otherwise. And you can do that. You can say, look, if that happens, just let be what is. But you have to say it, and somebody has to understand it, and somebody else has to write it down, and somebody else has to report it to the attending physician. Well, in this instance, when they were in the observational phase of the study, the question only came up about a third of the time. Now, that's a little surprising, given who we're talking about. Again, we're not talking about college kids and car wrecks. We're talking about aging people with a coin flip's chance of making it 6 months. It only came up a third of the time. When it came up, and now we're talking just about the people in that one-third time, when it came up, the doctor understood the patient's preference to forego CPR about half the time. So half the time, the patient's preferences were not recorded. They were not written down. And in a few of the cases, when the heart stopped, all hell broke loose against the patient's wishes, because that's the default. So it was only raised a third of the time. When it was raised, it only got understood and written down half the time. And when it got written down, it wasn't written down until within 2 days of the patient's death. And many of these patients were in the hospital for months. I have this image in my head of someone who's expressed a preference to have CPR, to forego CPR, and just sort of asking, maybe literally, is it written, 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 not yet, not yet, not yet. They wrote it. Whew, safe to go. Whew, 2 days later or within. So the question only came up a third of the time. It was only understood half the time, and when it was understood half the time, it didn't get written until the very end. So this is not a question that, at least in 1988 to 1990, was well addressed. Here's how these folks wound up having their lives end. 10 or more undesirable days. I'll talk about what undesirable is in a minute. But 10 days, that doesn't seem like a very long time, unless you think about the fact that it was 10 days ago that we last met as a class. Seems like ancient history now, doesn't it? 10 days, as it were. Now, what does undesirable mean? Half the people in this study had their lives end in what's called severe pain. Now, I went for an annual physical this morning, and one of the things on my list of things to address is I have a balky shoulder. My shoulder hurts. It doesn't hurt when I'm doing this. It hurts like crazy when I do this. And then he pushed it. Does it? Yeah. Well, they ask, are you in pain? Yes, I have a sore shoulder. Well, is on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is it? Well, right now it's a 0. Here, I said it's 3 or 4, but that was actually wimpy. In this regard, it was probably a 2, maybe, would be more accurate, because we're tough. But anyway, these are people that if you were to ask them what's your pain like, they would say 10. Well, what does 10 mean? Who's ever broken a bone? Any bone, pick a bone, any bone. Hurts like crazy, doesn't it? How many bones do we have in our bodies? One of you science geeks. How many? 206? Okay. Let's imagine you've got metastatic cancer that has invaded your bones. And that means that there are holes or lesions or tumors on a bone, which makes it feel just like it's broken. And let's say it's only invaded a fourth of your bones, which is not uncommon at all. I knew a guy in a hospital one time that had, the doctor said, 90% of your bones are affected. Let's just say a quarter. That's 50 bones, right? Ish, 51 and a half. That means that what it feels like is that 51 bones in your body are broken. Can you imagine taking that pain that you know from having broken an ankle, a wrist, a rib, an arm, and multiplying it by 50? That's what we're talking about. We can medicate it better than we do, but some doctors in some places, especially in teaching hospitals, because they are under surveillance by the Drug Enforcement Administration, are reluctant to prescribe heavy narcotics. We might make them addicted. Hello. Let's take these deck chairs on the Titanic and make them in a nice straight little row. I don't mind being addicted to morphine if I've got 6 months to live. And my pain is starting to escalate beyond 2. So what did they do? They spent $25 million trying to change these numbers. They gave the next 4,500 patients in the study specific and direct and eyeball-to-eyeball information about what their prognosis was. I mean, they told them and told them and told them and then told them again. And then they told them one more time and then another time. And then they said, you got it? Yes. What do you want? I mean, they did it in a much more gentle way. They gave the institution the numbers I just showed you. They gave the hospital all those charts on how often the question was raised, how often when it was raised it was understood, and once it was understood, how long it took to implement. They hired people who were especially skilled and then further trained to enhance communication and had the medical background to do it. Nurses and nurse practitioners did this. They spent $25 million trying to get the CPR question raised earlier. When it was raised, trying to get the doctors to understand it, and when the doctors understood it, to write the order earlier. $25 million with highly skilled and highly trained people in a setting that's supposed to at least address the health needs of the patient, depending on who the patient is, and here's what happened. The intervention, there's only one word that matters on that slide. What's the word? It's in the first line. Not. They poured $20 million down the biohazard sink. I mean, they did. It didn't change the number of times or the percentage of the time the question got raised, when it got raised, how often the doctor understood it, and once it was understood, getting it written quicker, or it didn't reduce the unpleasant circumstances of death. This hit the medical world pretty hard. For only 2 or 3 years later, and I was on UMC's ethics committee at the time this occurred. This presentation was given to us who were on UMC's ethics committee. End-of-life decision-making became the top item of interest for UMC's ethics committee on which I served, and that's how I got to go to the presentation. But anyway, the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations started to pay attention. And when JACO gets involved, if you know anybody that's a healthcare practitioner or works in a hospital, a pending JACO inspection stops time. Because if you don't get accredited, if Jayco doesn't pass you, you can't do business. Jayco added to its inspection and accreditation criteria end-of-life decision-making. Is this addressed? Is it addressed directly? Does every patient that comes into the hospital, are they asked if they have documentation of their wishes, and is that documentation on file, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It's changed the world. The hospice movement has taken off. Hospice doctors have much more leeway in providing end-of-life pain control than do general practitioners. So the hospice movement has taken off. Jayco has gotten involved. And you may know somebody that just going into the hospital for an appendectomy had to answer the question, do you have what's called an advance directive? There are two ways that you can, or someone you love, who may be a little closer to 65 and a coin flips away, can express your preferences more profoundly in ways that they finally have learned to understand. You can have an attorney, or actually go on the internet and get the template, draft what's called a living will. This is a document that is legally binding and legally available to hospitals and doctors that express your preference in the event that, and under these conditions, I would like to forego CP, et cetera, et cetera. Now, DNR, do not resuscitate, doesn't mean do nothing. I have written down, don't do nothing, bring my cat, Mozart, and my wife, and let them do whatever the heck they want. Right? And give me all the drugs you have. And when you run out, go buy more. That's essentially what it says. Until it just doesn't matter, you know. And what's interesting to me is there are now 5 states, and we had until Ferguson was a 24/7 news cycle, the woman who moved from California to Oregon and had legally written a prescription for an overdose of barbiturates because she had been given, oddly enough, the same cancer diagnosis that my friend Marge, that I was telling you about a minute ago, got. And she said she ended her life on her own terms, and we can now do that in 5 states. But you need what's called a living will. And in that living will, you also need to designate someone who holds the title of having durable power of attorney for health care. That means if you can't express these preferences, they will express them for you and can legally act on your behalf. So my stepdaughter said to me when I drafted this thing about 10 years ago, she said, I can pull the plug on you? I said, yes, you can. Under these conditions. We just had a big laugh about it. But it's a relief knowing that someone will express these wishes on my behalf. That's what you need. We have been both given the means and are supported in the warrant to at least be a partner in this decision making. It's like slowing down the freight train. It's making the freight train a passenger train anyway. And I think at the last, I'm the only one in here that's closer to, I'm probably the person in the room closest to age 65. And a lot of you know people in that age group that you care about very deeply. And you may, you know, at least be aware of the extent to which they have these documents in place, if that is their concern. I will also tell you, as a minister, one of the worst things that can happen to you is to be the person in the middle and trying to mediate an argument between siblings over what to do next. I have told people who argue or wonder or even just ask me directly, should we put the feeding tube in? Should we put the respirator on? I tell them, you're the only ones that can decide that, knowing your mother or somebody as you do. But I will tell you this, you do not have to unplug a machine you never plug in. And the inevitability may be that even if you plug it in, you will have to figure out at what point you unplug it or take it out. And you haven't lived until you have had a long relationship with someone you care about and an in-town adult child, that knows what their interests are. And suddenly, from somewhere else in the country at the last minute, a sibling who isn't and is grinding away his or her guilt feelings about having basically ignored mom or dad, comes in and says, no, 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 don't pull that plug now, when clearly they wanted it and they needed it. That's an entertaining room to be in if you're trying to mediate that. Well, what does all this mean? I think it means at the end of the day, at the end of this class, at the end of any day, really, that a heightened level of awareness about the value of each day is good for us. It was a big day in my life when I recognized the halftime show was over. This year, statistically, I hit the fourth quarter. It makes each day more valuable to me if I stop and think about it. And sometimes I have to force myself to stop and think about it. So I would ask you to do that at the end of this class, to stop and think about the value of each day. How do you want to do that? Well, we've talked about a lot of things over the course of the last 3 or 4 months. How do successful societies keep the wheels on with education, healthcare, religion, and family? How do successful or unsuccessful societies, for that matter, cope with the inevitable conflict between haves and have-nots? What's the deal with these subtle interactions, and how much more complicated have they become in a cyber world, right? And the question beneath all of that, it seems to me, is what difference does it make? Especially now, what difference does anybody make? Well, I'd like to tell you what difference anybody makes and how you can measure it. I want to start with a story that's really a metaphor. It's a story of my taking a final exam in high school physics, which was the last physics course I ever took because it's hard. High school physics. And I'm embellishing the story because that's what I do. But the last question on the exam was designed to both test our ability to do complicated mathematics or arithmetic, essentially, but also to make us think a little bit. And it's made me think in this way. The question was a story that involved a guy going fishing. That's all it is. Guy gets up to go fishing. Now comes the embellishment part. You know, he gets up early, packs his equipment, loads it in the car, hooks up the boat, makes himself a thermos of coffee, maybe stops and get a couple of biscuits at Sonic or whatever, goes to the lake, launches the boat, rows out to the middle. Beautiful day, quiet lake, sunrise just starting to break. Casts his line, pours himself a cup of coffee. Get the picture? Okay. It's a lake in northern Wisconsin, small lake. Suddenly, a fish strikes the line in the story. In the course of trying to reel in the fish, he inadvertently knocks the coffee cup into the lake and it spills the coffee. The physics question was, here is the volume of the lake in gallons, several million gallons. Here's the temperature of the water in the lake. Here's the volume of the coffee cup in ounces. And here's the temperature of the coffee. You know where this is going, right? You make the impossible assumption that the coffee is equally mixed. How much did the lake temperature go up? Is the question of the final exam. And it involves manipulating very small numbers, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 40th degree, whatever it is, doesn't matter. What's beneath it, however, is the assumption that if you have a device sensitive enough to measure it, you can detect the impact of a cup of coffee spilled in a lake. That's the physics part. The metaphor is, if you have a device sensitive enough to measure it, you can detect the impact of one human life on the universe on any given day, if you have the device that will measure it. I'll tell you what that device is. It's not a machine. It's not a thermometer. It's a mindset. The mindset is related to compassion. Compassion. Now, what is that? I'll tell you what it's not. Compassion is not looking at the world from an ivory tower or from the standpoint of a college class or wherever it is you look at the world and go, you know what? That is a sad, sorry life over there where the Eiffel Tower is really tall, where the base is really wide. That's a sad, sorry life. That's a sad, sorry country. That's a sad, sorry person. What's for lunch? That's pity. And if you've ever been pitied by someone, it drives you nuts. Sort of emotional torture to be pitied by someone. Compassion, on the other hand, though, compassion is different in that a compassionate mindset will tell, you'll tell yourself, that sad, sorry country, that sad, sorry situation, that sad, sorry person is experiencing something that on any given day could happen to me. You cannot predict the convergence of time or circumstance. You cannot say, I will never wind up in the middle of a riot in Ferguson, Missouri. You can never say, my house will never get smashed by a tornado. You can't say, I will never wind up with a coin flip's chance of living 6 months. You can't say that. And there is nothing that can happen to anybody that couldn't happen to anybody There's nothing that can happen to anybody that couldn't happen to you. And when you know that, you will become a more gentle person. You will value each day a little bit more. You will be a little bit less judgmental and a little bit more tolerant. And by that measure, you will change the world. Now you can tell Rick Perry this, how I change the world. And thank you very, very much.